So the question is, if it's a poorly worded objection, am I going to deny the opportunity for a hearing? And the answer is, those hearings get self-scheduled, and I call the case, and then I deny it.
I took your Diet Coke away from you. That's too much caffeine. Yeah.
And while Judge Jones gets to the next question, you know, we're lucky to have Aaron here because I think as attorneys, I think most of us are attorneys in the room, there are certain things that we take for granted. And especially when you get an order on a claim objection that says that the objection is granted. I mean, Aaron, how do you deal with something like that? And what kind of problems does that cause for you?
Yeah, going back to what Judge Lopez said, it's really important to put what you are asking of the court in the order. Oftentimes, we get orders entered that say the order is granted, and then I get a call from the claims agent, what am I supposed to do to effectuate this on the claims register? So while it's first and foremost informative of the court so that they know what they're being asked to enter, it's also informative to the process and can waterfall down through the process. If the claims agent gets it wrong and they become the distribution agent, then the distribution may be improper pursuant to the plan. So it really does practically impact the case as well.
And it can make it very difficult for creditors whose claims were impacted to understand what's going on, you know, because maybe you're reclassifying a claim, maybe you're reducing a claim. And if you have just an order that says, you know, the objection is granted, it doesn't achieve a lot of the ends, and it causes a lot of confusion and complexity.
Good morning. I have a question about why on every proof of claim form, when it says penalty for presenting fraudulent claim, fine of up to $500,000 or imprisonment for up to 5 years or both, 18 U.S.C. 152-3571, why is that not enforced more? Why I've never seen it enforced, and I'm wondering if anybody can explain how this issue could be resolved or at least dampened by just making it a lot more downside, a lot riskier for people to file a frivolous or fraudulent claim.
You know, I can say quickly there would need to be a criminal referral made, and more often than not, you know, we'll file objections to those claims, and it's addressed, you know, on the civil side in the bankruptcy case itself. I don't think I've ever made a referral, even though I've dealt with some fraudulent proofs of claim.
Let me give two comments. One, in the Tailored Brands case, I had three employees that each filed $500,000 proofs of claim, or maybe it was $5 million. $5 million proofs of claim. $500 million proofs of claim. $500 million proofs of claim. And I set show cause hearings for them on exactly that basis. And we held show cause hearings. I didn't end up referring them. It's not worth going into what happened, but I don't think we ignore it. But they have to be pretty obvious to trigger the judge to do something, I think, like these were. Second, I just want to raise a comment to what Freeman said, which is, I mean, I just had a series of hearings where her firm had attached an order that I thought, the way the motion was is you can figure out why we're objecting by looking at the attachment to the order because it then gives the detailed objection. And the detail was, we don't owe the money. And so I held a rant similar to what I did a few minutes ago. And then they came back with an order and it had a table and it said, we don't owe the money because we paid by check 1416 this amount of money on that date. And then I complimented the lawyer sitting right here who had the guts to come back and do the right thing once they had done the wrong thing. But that's what we need to know. We need to know why you're objecting. And it shouldn't be some generic boilerplate.
Yeah, and so that's a good transition into, you know, attaching
really?
a declaration or an affidavit.
Is it really?
To the claim. You know, Aaron's here, and a lot of times what we see are these legalese declarations that are attached that are the same in every single case, and I would put those on the bad side of a declaration. So, Aaron, when you're a declarant, what are you wanting to put in a declaration?
Plain English. To Julie's point, oftentimes I get my declaration from counsel and I read it and I'm like, oh my goodness, these words would never come out of my mouth. So I would encourage, if you're drafting a declaration, especially if it's your first time working with a declarant, to pick up the phone and call them and ask them, okay, what is your personal knowledge of this claim and the objection basis of this claim, and how would you articulate it if you were on the stand giving testimony? Because really, that's all a declaration is. It's a proffer of our testimony.
So what do you think about books and records? I reviewed the debtor's books and records. We don't know the claim.
I think it's too vague. What books and records? I looked in the Great Plains system and I determined that there's no record of this invoice. I looked in our checking accounts and I determined that this was paid via, you know, check 1400 on this date in this amount. To the extent it's a contract dispute, you know, I went to the person who negotiated this contract, and in that instance, quite frankly, I would probably push back on counsel if they were asking me to be the declarant, because the person who negotiated the contract may be a better declarant. So just really thinking through, do you have personal knowledge, and what is that specific, precise personal knowledge that you have that makes you confident what you're asking the court to do with respect to the claim is appropriate?